On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures, about media, propaganda, and democracy. A series of five talks, one each night this week, divided into 16 sections, including questions from a panel of distinguished Canadian journalists. The Massey Lectures have been an annual event on CBC Radio for the past 27 years. Leading figures in politics and the arts, literature and the sciences have been featured, including John Kenneth Galbraith, George Steiner, Sir Stafford Beer, Willy Brandt, R.D. Lang, and George Grant. The 1988 Massey Lectures are given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky is the leading scholar in the field of structural linguistics and was last month awarded the $380,000 Kyoto Prize, the Japanese equivalent of the Nobel Prize, for his scientific work. He's also published a number of books of political criticism, focusing especially on the place of the United States in international affairs. His latest book, written with co-author Edward Herman, is called Manufacturing Consent: The Political Economy of the Mass Media. In his first talk in this series last night, Noam Chomsky said that a primary function of the mass media is to mobilize public support for the special interests that dominate the government and the private sector. Perhaps this is an obvious point, but the common assumption seems to be that the media are independent and committed to discovering and reporting the truth. In countries where the levers of power are in the hands of a state bureaucracy, monopolistic control of the media makes it clear that the media serve the ends of the dominant elite. It is much more difficult to see a propaganda system at work where the media are private and formal censorship is absent. These Massey lectures are titled Necessary Illusions, a phrase taken from the writings of Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr concluded that ordinary people were hardly capable of understanding the world without being subjected to a set of what he called necessary illusions, what we'd call propaganda, constructed by the intellectual elites. The system for managing this has turned out to be the mass media. Tonight, Professor Chomsky will talk about containing the enemy at home and abroad, a project of the corporate media that ranges from red scares to business-oriented public relations. The 1988 Massey Lectures, Part 4. Noam Chomsky.
Last night I mentioned three models of media organization. First model is corporate monopoly, the second, state-controlled media, and the third, a democratic communications policy, as advanced by the Brazilian bishops who I quoted. The first model, that is, the model of corporate monopoly, that reduces democratic participation to zero, just as other corporations are in principle exempt from popular control by workforce or community. In the case of state-controlled media, democratic participation might vary depending on how the political system functions. In practice, the state media are generally kept in line by the forces that have the power to dominate the state and by an apparatus of cultural managers that cannot stray far from the bounds they set. The third model, the model of a democratic communications policy, that is untried in practice, just as a sociopolitical system with significant popular engagement remains largely a concern for the future, either a hope or a fear, depending on one's evaluation of the right of the public to shape their own affairs. The model of media as corporate monopoly is the natural system for capitalist democracy. It has, accordingly, reached its highest form in the most advanced of these societies, particularly the United States, where public radio and television are limited in scope and elements of the radical democratic model exist only at the margins in listener-supported radio or the alternative or local press. In this respect, the United States represents the form towards which capitalist democracy is tending. There are other related tendencies, including the progressive elimination of unions and other popular organizations that interfere with private power, an electoral system that is increasingly stage-managed as a public relations exercise, avoidance of welfare measures such as national health insurance that impinge upon the prerogatives of the privileged, and so on. From this perspective, it's quite reasonable for Cyrus Vance and Henry Kissinger to describe the United States as a model democracy, democracy now being understood as a system of business control of political as well as other major institutions. Other Western democracies are generally a few steps behind in these respects. Most have not yet achieved the U.S. system of one political party with two factions controlled by shifting segments of the business community. Rather, they still retain parties based on working people and the poor, and to some extent representing their interests. But these are declining, along with cultural institutions that sustain different values and concerns, and along with organizational forms that provide isolated individuals with the means to think and to act outside the framework imposed by private power. For obvious reasons, the political class and the cultural managers are drawn generally from the sectors that dominate the private economy. The radical Democrats of the 17th century English Revolution held that it, as they put it, will never be a good world while knights and gentlemen make us laws. It will never be well with us till we have parliaments of countrymen like ourselves that know our wants. But Parliament and the preachers had a different vision. When we mention the people, they held, we do not mean the confused, promiscuous body of the people. The same controversy arose in the early days of the American Revolution. Under the earlier Confederation, artisans, farmers, and others of the common people had demanded that they be represented by men of their own kind. They had learned from the revolutionary experience that they were as capable as anyone of deciding what was wrong in their lives and of organizing themselves so they could do something about it. But that was not to be. The representatives of the people do not come from or return to the workplace. Rather, they come from and return to law offices catering to business interests, executive suites, and other places of privilege. As for the media, in England, a lively labor-oriented press reaching a broad public existed into the 1960s. At that point, it was finally eliminated through the workings of the market. At the time of its demise in 1964, the Daily Herald had over five times as many readers as the Times, and it had almost double the readership of the Times, the Financial Times, and the Guardian combined. But this journal, partially owned by the unions and labor-oriented, appealed to the wrong people, James Curran points out in a study of the decline of the independent media. The same was true of other elements of the social democratic press that died at the same time. They appealed to the wrong people, and they died in large part because they were deprived of the same level of subsidy through advertising and private capital as sustained what's called the quality press, which not only reflects the values and interests of its middle-class readers, Curran points out, but also gives them force, clarity, and coherence, and plays an important ideological role in amplifying and renewing the dominant political consensus. There are, then, natural processes at work to facilitate the control of enemy territory at home. Similarly, the global planning that was undertaken by U.S. elites during and after World War II assumed that principles of liberal internationalism would satisfy what they described as the requirement of the United States in a world in which it proposes to hold unquestioned power. The global policy goes under the name of containment. The manufacture of consent at home is its domestic counterpart. The two policies are, in fact, closely intertwined, since the domestic population must be mobilized to pay the costs of containment, and these costs may be severe, both material and moral costs. The rhetoric of containment is designed to give a defensive cast to the project of global management, and it therefore serves as part of the domestic system of thought control. It's rather remarkable that the terminology is so easily adopted given the questions that it begs. The underlying assumption is that there's a stable international order that the United States must defend. The general contours of this international order were developed by U.S. planners during and after World War II. They recognized the extraordinary scale of U.S. power, and they proposed to construct a global system that the United States would dominate and within which U.S. business interests would thrive. As much of the world as possible was to constitute what they called a grand area, and that grand area would be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. Within the grand area, other capitalist societies would be encouraged to develop, but without the kinds of protective devices that would interfere with U.S. prerogatives. In particular, only the United States would be permitted to dominate regional systems. The United States moved to take effective control over world energy production, and it organized a world system in which the various components would fulfill their functions within the overall framework of order managed by the United States, as Henry Kissinger was later to explain. The Soviet Union has been considered the major threat to the planned international order for quite good reasons. In part, this follows from its very existence as a great power controlling an imperial system that could not be incorporated within the grand area. In part, this follows from the occasional efforts of the Soviet Union to expand the domains of its power, as in Afghanistan. But it's important to understand how broadly the concept of defense is construed if we wish to evaluate the assessment of Soviet crimes. Thus, the Soviet Union is a threat to world order if it provides support for people opposing U.S. designs, for example, the South Vietnamese, who were engaged in what the U.S. government called internal aggression against their selfless American defenders. Or the Soviet Union is a threat to order if it supports Nicaraguans, who are illegitimately combating the depredations of the U.S.-run democratic resistance, as it's called. Such actions prove that Soviet leaders are not serious about détente and cannot be trusted, so statesmen and commentators soberly observe. Thus, Nicaragua will be a prime place to test the sanguine forecast that Gorbachev is now turning down the heat in the Third World, so the Washington Post editors explain, placing the onus for the U.S. attack against Nicaragua on the Russians, while warning of the threat of this Soviet outpost to overwhelm and terrorize its neighbors. Although containing the Soviet Union has been the dominant theme of U.S. foreign policy only since the United States became a truly global power after World War II, the Soviet Union had been considered an intolerable threat to order since the Bolshevik Revolution. Accordingly, it has been the main enemy of the elite media. In 1920, Walter Lippmann and Charles Mertz produced a critical study of New York Times coverage of the Bolshevik Revolution. They describe this coverage as nothing short of a disaster from the point of view of professional journalism. Editorial policy, which was deeply hostile to the Bolsheviks, profoundly and crassly influenced their news columns. For subjective reasons, the Times staff accepted and believed most of what they were told by the U.S. government and the agents and adherents of the old regime. They dismissed Soviet peace offers as merely a tactic to enable the Bolsheviks to concentrate their energies for a renewed drive toward worldwide revolution and the imminent Red invasion of Europe. The Bolsheviks, Lippmann and Mertz wrote, were portrayed as simultaneously both cadaver and worldwide menace, and the Red peril appeared at every turn to obstruct the restoration of peace in Eastern Europe and Asia and to frustrate the resumption of economic life. When President Wilson called for intervention, the New York Times responded by urging that we drive the Bolsheviki out of Petrograd and Moscow. Change a few names and dates, and we have a rather fair appraisal of the treatment of Indochina yesterday and Central America today by the national media. With regard to the Soviet Union, the concept of containment has had two variants over the years. The doves were reconciled to a form of containment in which the Soviet Union would dominate roughly the areas occupied by the Red Army in the war against Hitler. The Hawks had much broader aspirations. These were expressed in what was called the rollback strategy. It was outlined in an important national security memorandum, NSC 68 of April 1950, shortly before the Korean War. This crucial document was made public in 1975. NSC 68 interpreted containment, in, I'm quoting it now, as intended to foster the seeds of destruction within the Soviet system and to make it possible to negotiate a settlement with the Soviet Union or a successor state or states. Establishment of grand area principles abroad and necessary illusions at home does not simply await the hidden hand of the market. At home, the state has often employed force to curb dissent, and there have been regular campaigns by business to control the public mind and suppress challenges to private power when implicit controls do not suffice. The ideology of anti-communism has generally served this purpose since World War I. In earlier years, we were defending ourselves from other evil forces, the Huns, the British, the Spanish, the Mexicans, the Canadian Papists, and the merciless Indian savages, as they're called in the Declaration of Independence. But since the Bolshevik Revolution, and particularly in the era of bipolar world power that emerged from the ashes of World War II, a more credible enemy has been the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that seeks to subvert our noble endeavors, in John F. Kennedy's phrase, Ronald Reagan's evil empire. In the early Cold War years, Dean Acheson and Paul Nitze planned to bludgeon the mass mind of top government, as Acheson put it, with a frightening portrayal of the communist threat. In a scholarly monograph on post-war planning, William Borden points out that their goal was to overcome public, business, and congressional desires for peace, low taxes, and sound fiscal policies, and to mobilize popular support for the full-scale rearmament they felt necessary to overcome communist ideology and Western economic vulnerability. The Korean War served these purposes admirably. The ambiguous and complex interactions that led to the war were ignored in favor of the more useful image of a Kremlin campaign of world conquest. Dean Acheson, meanwhile, observed that in the Korean hostilities, an excellent opportunity is offered to disrupt the Soviet peace offensive, which is assuming serious proportions and having a certain effect on public opinion. These manipulations provided a standard for later practice. In earlier years, Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare effectively demolished unions and other dissident elements. A prominent feature was the suppression of independent politics and free speech, based on the principle that the state is entitled to act to prevent improper thought or its expression. Wilson's Creel Commission, dedicated to creating war fever among the generally pacifist population, had demonstrated the efficacy of organized propaganda with the cooperation of the media and the intellectuals. They devoted themselves to such tasks as historical engineering. That's the term that was devised by historian Frederick Paxson, who was one of the founders of the National Board for Historical Service, established by U.S. historians, to serve the state by, quote, explaining the issues of the war that we might the better win it. There are two lasting institutional consequences. One was the rise of the public relations industry, one of whose leading figures, Edward Bernays, had served on the wartime propaganda commission, and another was the establishment of the FBI as, in effect, the national political police, and that is a primary function that it serves until today. The effectiveness of the state corporate propaganda system is, in fact, quite remarkable. It's illustrated by the fate of May Day. May Day is a workers' holiday throughout the world. It originated in response to the judicial murder of several anarchists after the Haymarket Affair of May 1886. This was part of a campaign of international solidarity with U.S. workers who were struggling for an 8-hour day. In the United States, all of this is quite unknown. May Day has become what's called Law Day. It's a jingoist celebration of our 200-year-old partnership between law and liberty, as Ronald Reagan declared, while designating May 1st as Law Day 1984. And he added that without law, there can be only chaos and disorder. The day before, he had announced that the United States would disregard the proceedings of the International Court of Justice that later condemned the United States for its unlawful use of force and violation of treaties in its attack against Nicaragua. Law Day also served as the occasion for Reagan's declaration of May 1, 1985, announcing an embargo against Nicaragua. Reagan actually declared a national emergency, which has since been renewed annually because, in the official wording, the policies and actions of the government of Nicaragua constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. All of this was with the approbation of Congress, the media, and the intellectual community generally, or in some circles, embarrassed silence. The submissiveness of the society to business dominance was secured by Wilson's Red Scare, but it began to erode during the Great Depression. In 1938, the board of directors of the National Association of Manufacturers described the hazard facing industrialists in the newly realized political power of the masses. Unless their thinking is directed, it warned, we are definitely headed for adversity. Combined with strong-arm methods, propaganda campaigns were used quite effectively to subdue the labor movement in subsequent years. These propaganda campaigns spent millions of dollars to tell the public that nothing was wrong and that grave dangers lurked in the proposed remedies of the unions, so the La Follette Committee of the Senate observed in its study of business propaganda. In the post-Second World War period, the public relations campaign intensified, employing the media and other devices to identify what was called free enterprise, that means state-subsidized private profit with no infringement on managerial prerogatives, and that had to be identified as the American way threatened by dangerous subversives. In 1954, Daniel Bell, who was at that time an editor of Fortune magazine, wrote that it has been industry's prime concern in the post-war years to change the climate of opinion ushered in by the Depression. This, quote, free enterprise campaign has two essential aims: to rewin the loyalty of the worker, which now goes to the union, and to halt creeping socialism. By creeping socialism is meant the mildly reformist capitalism of the New Deal. The scale of business public relation campaigns, Bell continues, was staggering through advertising in press and radio and other means. And the effects were soon seen in legislation constraining union activity and the attack on independent thought that's often mislabeled McCarthyism. In fact, McCarthy was a latecomer. More generally, any articulate challenge to business domination was eliminated during this period. The media and intellectual community cooperated with enthusiasm. The universities in particular were effectively purged, and they remained so until the crisis of democracy dawned and students and younger faculty began to ask the wrong kinds of questions in the 1960s. At that point, there was a renewed, though less effective, purge, while in a further exercise of necessary illusion, it was claimed, and still is, that the universities were virtually taken over by left-wing totalitarians. To decode that and turn it into English, what it means is that the grip of orthodoxy was somewhat relaxed. As early as 1947, a State Department public relations officer remarked that smart public relations has paid off, as it has before and will again. Public opinion is not moving to the right, he said. It has been moved. While the rest of the world has moved to the left, admitted labor into government, passed liberalized legislation, the United States has become anti-social change, anti-economic change, anti-labor, thanks to this public relations campaign.